This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location with Judith Bowles. Judy, we call her. And she has a new book, and she's going to read part of it for us right now. Judy Bowles.
Good morning. Let me just say that it is a huge pleasure for me to be here and to be with Grace, who I've listened to on the radio since the 70s and have sort of slowly approached poetry, thanks to her sort of seductive way of summoning us to be the best we can. I'll read a poem about one of the endless trips that as a child I took with my mother and my brother to her hometown in Pennsylvania. They spoke of the river. They spoke of the river, the children always, when starting the drive from Ohio to their mother's hometown of high hills and one artesian well. Willows hung down electric green into the muddy banks, holding the water that moved sluggishly back toward home with no real intention. It made them feel big, driving against the tide and seeing the willow stand still. The boy told about birds that traveled using water as their road. When the highway turned east from the river, they knew they were near the state line and the sign saying, "Welcome to Pennsylvania," with so many letters dense with N's, like the hills and dark stones that closed in the flatland left behind in Ohio and its wide open name. The girl got sick before she could say it, and the car filled with the smell made worse for not being home, for being on the other side.
This is the title poem of a book, a locus, a sense of place. This is the river that runs through this third book, I think. How do you describe your own poems in this book? How would you say if somebody says, well, what are these poems about?
They're about knowing. When I say that, I don't mean like a great wisdom. What I mean is, you know, the moment in our town when Emily has to go back, she goes back for her birthday. She's dead. She's in the grave and she goes back and it's her birthday and it's the morning and everything that happens is so crucial and so intense and she can't bear it because she knows the death is coming.
I think that describes this book perfectly.
Oh, does it?
There's also that innocence that she has that is, I think, framing the poems. But give us two in a row, and then we can talk about them. Judith Bowles, this is The Poet and the Poem. We're on location, but we're at the Library of Congress, in essence.
Mm-hmm. Great. Second poem, Reversal, is very, very different in some ways and not in others. Here it is. It's a reversal. It is Sunday. I will write a poem about a camel. I wish I could lumber along like he does, carrying the lump of himself with such ease on his two-toed soft feet. Unlikely to meet him at Mount Vernon like I did. It was Christmas last year. He was imported as an unusual attraction and to remind visitors that the Christmas of 1787, George Washington brought a camel to his house on the hill to enliven and amaze the season with a creature so big and so oddly made. But perhaps not so strange to the enslaved at that home, who remembered Africa and told their children of caravans of those camels who did more than chew and spit. They carried the burdens of men.
And let's hear the next.
Estimated losses. Two old men walk through the mist, assuring their feet at each step of a safe landing. The shorter of the two with the beard says, "It was all such crucial material, but never as gripping as it ought to be." The other man agrees, looking ahead toward the intersection where the eye of a red light is wide open to hold the world still, and says, "It was all just numbers." With his arm out like a bar, halts his friend. Green sets them loose, and they cross.
If ever I will teach how the poet notices, I will use that poem. It is just standing there and seeing. Not only looking, but seeing. And that is the gift the poet has to have. But I want to go back to the camel, because it does something that you do a lot. And that is, you have this gentle rebuke of the ugly. You know, but I want to say gentle, because you always start in beauty. And then this stripe of reality cuts across your poem. And we set up straight, you know. But that you start in beauty makes the reader safe. Your poems make us safe. Do you have any idea what that means as the writer? You probably don't.
I certainly know as a reader, the wild geese, you do not have to be good. In other words, right away, okay, then I'm good if I don't have to be good. You know, yes, to be safe, to be somehow embraced, to actually be noticed, have the poem almost notice you. You feel that way sometimes when you really, not always, but this poem knows me.
Oh, that's a perfect way to put it, because it is what we want is the reader to feel what we feel. I mean, that's what we wish, you know, that we're, why do we bother? But in your work, there is this enchantment with the world, and then this recognition, this pain that makes wisdom in a way. Mm-hmm. So it's in almost every poem. And I think it gives you the deeper reality, the richness, because they appear, your poetry, you use simple language, colloquial language, very lyrical. And so we are summoned in, but then we know what it feels to be alive. And then we know the compassion it takes to feel what we do. So I think poets are pretty important. It's our job, you know. Let's hear another piece. I have to say that Judith has two other collections. This is her third book, and they are called, let me see, The Gatherer and Unlocatable Source. They were both published by WordTech, and she was the poet in residence at Bainbridge Island in Washington. I had a baby in Whidbey Island. Did you visit that, Whidbey Island?
No. No, didn't.
Bainbridge, though, it rained too much.
Oh, but Bainbridge is an incredible place. Incredible.
It's quite beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
What part of the year were you there?
I was there in the, hold on 2 seconds. I was there. They had a lot of trillium. And so it was the late spring.
That's rainy too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the greenery. But let us have a poem. Okay. Judy Bowles.
Black Hand. The Hocking Hills rise solid and dark out of Ohio flatland. Caves and gorges take their shape from thick, massive beds of Black Hand sandstone, named for a dark hand with spread fingers carved on the cliff wall. A message to traveling tribes. Halt! Do not enter. The land doesn't welcome any more than my grandfather did us, Sunday after Sunday, any more than he did my father's left hand, strapped to a chair at meals so he would eat like he should. Years later, Father used that same hand to silence his heart once and for all. The state blasted the cliff away for a walk along the Erie Canal.
There you go. You start with this scenery and you make it very painterly, and we get a picture of something. And then we go deeper into something pretty scary. You insert that, and then you widen the lens to return to the country. So I think you're teaching us how to insert things. How to insert things. It's like a bow. You have a big part, and then you have a little middle, and then you expand again. And that's a nice piece of structure. It just came naturally for that piece of writing?
Thank you, Jen. Yes, it was much longer. And then I sort of trimmed because I didn't say too much. I mean, I feel that the objects in the poem say so much. The sandstone itself, I mean, when I learned about the Black Hand, and when I learned that it had been, you know, it was ancient, and then it was blasted away to make a walkway.
And in that, your grandfather was trying to blast away that part of your father, mm-hmm. which today mm-hmm. is so abusive, mm-hmm. but that's what made our parents. That's what made our grandparents. And, you know, that's what's in our DNA.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yes. I think family traumas come down from all generations, I think.
You know, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I just said I have a Huguenot background. And so the Huguenot persecution and the leaving from France in the 17th century and coming to this country, I think all of that trauma, I think, comes along with the family as it comes down in different ways. But I do think it's in our DNA, as you say, it's in our hand motions.
In our hand motions. Now that's the poet talking. Another person would have stopped after DNA. Yeah, but that trauma is our muse.
Amen. Well. Amen. Thank you. Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. And it's that trauma that you had a bravery to face, and that it took me a long time to be able to face it, except just in piecemeal. I could just face it in piecemeal, and then as I've gotten older, I have gotten braver, thanks to icons like you.
You're saying something really crucial, and it is finding the wound. Mm. And until we find the wound, we really can't. And why would we want to? Mm. I mean, that's what writing is. It's courage. Mm. And now that you have found that you can make it beautiful, is it easier to write?
Yes, but still, especially when the times are hard like these, you know, and when you feel yourself a little bit swamped by circumstances, you know, like what has happened in to many of us. So it's a little. I think it, sometimes also in my poems, I sort of kid myself a little bit. I say I'm writing about heliotrope, and then I'm really something else. It's the triggering town, but I'm writing about a heliotrope just to get, because they're so beautiful and the way they follow the light. So I like that. So it's like I'm doing something. Okay, come on. You can go in this door because look, this is going to be nice.
That's exactly what you do. And we're so glad that you frame your pain in something, as I say, that lets us rest in it. And you earned your MFA at American. Mm-hmm. And that's where you know our darling David Keplinger?
No, well, yes, I know him now, but that was long, long before his day. That was the day when Myra's Clarue had just started the program.
Oh, my. I didn't know that. And then you taught creative writing, too.
Yes. Well, and I was not in poetry at that time. I couldn't bear to be in poetry, but I did take Myra's class in modern poetry. And I have to say that opened a door for me that I thought was I could always close when I wanted to.
Oh, and then you could not.
Yes.
Then you could not. Oh, I love that. You thought you could close the door.
Yes.
Let's hear another poem, Judy Bowles.
Okay. Heliotrope. The stem of the heliotrope turns the flowers. It is in charge of finding the light. Like my mother, each summer loading us in her car, its air laden with cigarettes, that took us to her mother and sisters. A house as full of sorrows as the porch morning glories stretched on strings. When certain names were said, something stopped, and our hearts knew that Joseph and Josephine and Francis used to be there, but were never coming back. Our mother and her mother and sisters looked a long time towards each other to tell us so.
Glad you read that one, because it exemplifies the mystery. In your work, you leave us always with a little mystery, something unsaid. Of course, all poetry has a mystery in it, but yours is built that way. You design it that way so that we know something, but we're left not knowing everything. It's like the silence, not talking to your father, or the difficulty with a task with your mother. There's that silence in the middle of your poem that we live, so we know what it's like. We feel what it's like to have something unknown that we can't quite reach. And that is your strong point. Because it's not anecdotes. They aren't anecdotes. You know, you're not talking about going visiting and then you find it, there's something changed. The silence that is embedded in the poem is this thing in your own life that was so hard to cross. Thank you for bringing that to poetry.
Oh, well, thank you for acknowledging it. Thank you for, because our poems, we are our poems, don't you think? They are us, and we have live in them in some form. If somebody is a careful enough reader like you are, just to acknowledge them, it's a big task. Writing and reading poetry, I think. I mean, it's a wonderful task, but it encompasses so much, Grace, so much.
Well, for us, we're little archaeologists. You know? But then the thing, your poetry can be read for pleasure, and it can be read for pain. And that is quite a trick, quite a trick. When you taught the seniors, and we are among them now,
yes.
at Iona for so many years, what did you learn from them?
Oh, what did I learn from them? Well, first of all, I learned that I wanted to know if I could work with seniors, and so I did a few things. Kenneth Koch had just come out with a book called I Never Told Anybody. He did the poetry in the schools, but he also did poetry with older people. He went to a nursing home and came up with a book, I Never Told Anybody. So I read that book and I thought to myself, aha, I could do that. So I sort of started around to nursing homes, and I would get people that were well enough, and I would have them smell a rose and talk about that. And then I would type down what they said, and then I would bring it back the next week, and they were astounded at what they had said, and they were so happy. Mm. And so then I got hired to do just that at Iona. Iona was just starting.
Mm.
And what I learned was something that's serving me so well now, because I'm in a senior facility, a continuing care, a Quaker community, which is wonderful. But I'm learning that behind the old faces and behind all of us our oldness, there exists this person that is shining.
Oh.
And that the more that you write, the more that you write, the better you get. I remember saying to my husband, Tom, you know, they're frail. But their language skills are the poetry I started. I was with them for 12 years.
Oh,
poetry that we started with and the poetry we ended up with, it's legendary.
Oh, I, that makes me cry because I feel, you know, age is real.
Mm-hmm.
And yet inside of each of us, Judith and Grace, there is a child that is still alive and mischievous and wandering and curious. And so you tap into that. And thank you for that. And how are you changed?
Oh, well, this is showing it. I think how am I changed? I am changed in being able to.
I mean, by working with them.
Oh, by
the
working.
Transformation.
Well, because when as I've grown old, I think about them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about how they celebrated their anniversaries, how they celebrate, how they did all. We celebrated many things together. We were very, very close. And it was in D.C. And it gave me the courage to get old. I mean, they were there and they were doing their best and they were loving and careful with each other. And I just wanted to be like them one day, not then. I wanted to be young then, definitely. I wanted to be younger.
I'm with you. But we says we lost that hand. So the thing is, we can maintain joy, right?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. We can maintain joy. Yes.
And let's hear another poem. Judy okay. Bowles.
Thanks, dear. Well, one of the things that happens in age is some parts of us don't work quite as well as... As they used
to. Oh, you noticed.
Yes. And for instance, I have a finger which has a will of its own and it won't anymore do.
Oh, is it called a trigger finger?
Well, it's not a trigger finger, but it's a stable finger. It won't go down any more than. Well,
what does a poet do with a stable finger but write a poem about it?
Exactly.
So what else can you do with it?
And it's called Can the Dead Speak? My frozen forefinger, once out of the brace, it's been locked in for years by nerves that gave up or withdrew. It exists as it used to be somewhere in the upper region where thoughts are as real as the eggs in a bowl on the top shelf of the fridge that I boiled to be eaten when peeled.
I never thought of peeling them first. Well, I know you studied and taught. Your poems have appeared in many literary journals, Gargoyle, Innisfree, Delmarva, many, Cobalt, Starbucks, Ekphrastic Review. I won't read them all. But I'm really interested always in asking women about domesticity and the public life. Did you have a Was it easy to do everything, or did you have a push-pull taking care of the domestic scene and then trying to do your best outside of the house?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you? If it was easy, then, you know, mazel tov. I have a lot of grief. I have a little bit of guilt about being a career woman, but everyone turned out just fine.
Right, right. Well, look, because they can see what you've done with your life. So, you know, that's better than staying home and making cookies. I mean,
mm-hmm. Well, I think those people with the aprons don't have any guilt.
Well, I was more with the apron, but I did what I did when I felt like the kids were able to be, they were like in school and doing things. So I was very... I balanced all of that. And I taught, I was a teacher. And then right after I had my first child, I stopped teaching. And I had a divorce and other things happened then. But at any rate, the balance was easy for me in the beginning because I didn't think too much about it. I mean, I really didn't. I just sort of went my way. But when I began to think about ambition and to have ambition and to things like that, I found I was very thwarted. I mean, not so much by society as by the forces within me that said, oh, don't do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I began to realize that. I began to realize how real it was in my life. And I felt blindsided, like, wow. You know, when I am with people that, listened to their ambition and paid attention and went on with their lives that way, I'm in awe of them because I was very blighted about that.
That is so valuable, so valuable. Men are born with ambition as being a noble attribute. Mm-hmm. But you are quite right. To be ambitious or to want something, there is a speed bump for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because with that wish to either be noticed or recognized or published or get at that job, you know, there it is something in you that says, you know, you really don't deserve this or something like that. And I was just telling my own children who can change tires and build things, you know, I said, when we were little, we weren't ever taught how to take things apart and put them together or how to read a map.
Yeah.
That I think is so significant. Women, girls, were not taught to read maps because I guess they weren't supposed to go there.
But or be driven.
But when you live long enough, you know, you and I have gone through many transformations.
Yes.
We probably started out as geisha girls.
Yes.
But now we are writers. So please give us another poem.
Okay. An author that I have adored, I haven't talked too much about my influences, but W.S. Merwin is somebody that I would say is close to sacred to me, his work. And no, it is sacred to me. And in reading him, I sort of taught myself to read him by reading him out loud and seeing where I had to breathe. And that's where the sort of punctuation was. And so I wrote a poem. It's called Cautious Trapper. His breath is there. This is for W.S. Merwin. His breath is there to be found if his words are unlocked from the page through my hands to my heart, where a searchlight for pause recodes order like a path in the snow, made by a cautious trapper who knows every step of the way through the woods, even in winter, and wind shows its course through the dangling dry beach as a shimmering sound meant only for this earth, this day, in these woods.
Shimmering sound. There's the noticing. And the immediacy, you end with the immediacy. Here we are. This is now. Now is a miraculous time.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the title.
Well, I've never seen a trapper, but I can imagine, you know, you've seen animals trap, go after something. They're so stealthy and what they do. And I had a photograph that I don't even know what it was, of somebody in a black coat walking through the woods in the snow. And I always looked at that and I thought to myself, that's a trapper. So a cautious trapper is somebody that is going, well, Merwin knows exactly. I mean, every word seems so perfect. And yet, where does it come from? You know, there's this great mystery as to where all these, it comes from. But when you read it, when you're with it, you're absolutely, there's no other place you could be. There's no other footfall that you can make.
Oh, there's no other footfall you can make. Yeah, he knows his trail through the snow for sure. And we followed it. So please, Judith Bowles, whose work gives us a deeper reality, read us a final poem.
Oh, I will. And it's a recent one, May Flies. It was at Camp Plymouth Shore on Lake Erie. The summer after my dad left for the Navy, I flunked fifth grade arithmetic, stopped breathing during surgery, gotten fat eating too much, that mother left me. I hated my Huguenot name, Lefevre, and so did the girls in my cabin. Here comes typhoid, get out of town. Our counselor saved me and my friend Phyllis. With paper dolls, we pretended were us. Phyllis loved bugs, big ones and small. She slowed down for bugs and watched them, holding her breath to keep them safe. She was the happiest camper ever, covered with what were known as Canadian soldiers that swarmed on our bodies through the fields to the lake. She said they were nothing like soldiers. They were mayflies. Just think of that. Phyllis made things bigger by talking about them. She already knew things I never heard of. One morning, we skipped breakfast. To sneak into the counselor's bathroom, she opened the can labeled sanitary napkins with her foot. When I rushed to the door, she called out, "It doesn't hurt. The blood coming out." Phyllis said mayflies come from the lake, where they'd been a long time as eggs, maybe years, before growing wings and swarming the fields for a day. All that other life waiting, getting ready, like us.
And we are getting ready for this book.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of the book is what?
They Spoke of the River.
Judith Bowles. This is The Poet and the Poem. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Zinipit Fund, by the Rivada Foundation, by Natalie Canavor, Avide Shoshani, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.